So starting 1 Kings chapter 1. Now King David was old and advanced in years, and although they covered him with clothes, he could not get warm. Therefore his servants said to him, "Let a young woman be sought for my lord the king, and let her wait on the king and be in his service. Let her lie in your arms, that my lord the king may be warm." So they sought for a beautiful young woman throughout all the territory of Israel, and found Abishag the Shunammite, and brought her to the king. The young woman was very beautiful, and she was of service to the king and attended to him, but the king knew her not. Now Adonijah, the son of Haggith, exalted himself, saying, "I will be king." And he prepared for himself chariots and horsemen, and 50 men to run before him. His father had never at any time displeased him by asking, "Why have you done thus and so?" He was also a very handsome man, and he was born next after Absalom. He conferred with Joab, the son of Zeruiah, and Abathar the priest, and they followed Adonijah and helped him. But Zadok the priest and Benaiah the son of Joiada and Nathan the prophet and Shimei and Rei and David's mighty men were not with Adonijah. Adonijah sacrificed sheep, oxen, and fattened cattle by the serpent stone and is beside Enrogel, and he invited all his brothers, the king's sons, and all of the royal officials to Judah. But he did not invite Nathan the prophet, or Benaiah, or the mighty men, or Solomon his brother. Then Nathan said to Bathsheba, the mother of Solomon, "Have you not heard that Adonijah, the son of Haggith, has become king, and David, our lord, does not know it? Now therefore, come, let me give you advice, that you may save your own life and the life of your son Solomon. Go in at once to King David and say to him, 'Did you not, my lord the king, swear to your servant, saying, Solomon your son shall reign after me, and he shall sit on my throne? Then why is Adonijah king? Then, while you are still speaking with the king, I will also come in after you and confirm your words.'" So Bathsheba went to the king in his chamber. Now the king was very old, and Abishai the Shunammite was attending to the king. Bathsheba bowed and paid homage to the king, and the king said, "What do you desire?" She said to him, "My lord, you swore to your servant by the Lord your God, saying, 'Solomon your son shall reign after me, and he shall sit on my throne.' And now, behold, Adonijah is king, although you, my lord the king, do not know it. He has sacrificed oxen, fattened cattle, and sheep in abundance, and has invited all the sons of the king, Abathar the priest, and Joab the commander of the army. But Solomon your servant he has not invited. And now, my lord the king, the eyes of all Israel are on you, to tell them who shall sit on the throne of my lord the king after him. Otherwise it will come to pass, when my lord the king sleeps with his fathers, that I and my son Solomon will be counted offenders." While she was still speaking with the king, Nathan the prophet came in. And they told the king, "Here is Nathan the prophet." And when he came in before the king, he bowed before him with his face to the ground. And Nathan said, "My lord the king, have you said, 'Adonijah shall reign after me, and he shall sit on my throne'? For he has gone down this day and has sacrificed oxen, fattened cattle, and sheep in abundance, and has invited all the king's sons, the commanders of the army, and Abathar the priest. And behold, they are eating and drinking before him, and saying, 'Long live King Adonijah.' But me, your servant, and Zadok the priest, and Benaiah the son of Jehoiada, and your servant Solomon, he has not invited. Has this thing been brought about by my lord the king? And have you not told your servants who should sit on the throne of the Lord my king after him?"
Continuing our reading from verse 28. Then King David answered, Call Bathsheba to me. So she came into the king's presence and stood before the king. And the king swore, saying, As the Lord lives, who has redeemed my soul out of every adversity, as I swore to you by the Lord, the God of Israel, saying, Solomon your son shall reign after me, and he shall sit on my throne in my place. Even so will I do this day. Then Bathsheba bowed with her face to the ground and paid homage to the king and said, May my lord King David live forever. King David said, Call to me Zadok the priest, Nathan the prophet, and Benaiah the son of Jehoiada. So they came before the king. And the king said to them, Take with you the servants of your lord, and have Solomon my son ride on my own mule, and bring him down to Gihon. And let Zadok the priest and Nathan the prophet there anoint him king over Israel. Then blow the trumpet and say, Long live King Solomon! You shall then come up after him, and he shall come and sit on my throne, for he shall be king in my place. And I have appointed him to be ruler over Israel and over Judah. And Benaiah the son of Jehoiada answered the king, Amen! May the Lord, the God of my lord the king, say so. As the Lord has been with my lord the king, even so may he be with Solomon, and make his throne greater than the throne of my lord King David. So Zadok the priest, Nathan the prophet, and Benaiah the son of Jehoiada, and the Cherethites and the Pelethites, went down and made Solomon ride on King David's mule, and brought him to Gihon. There Zadok the priest took the horn of oil from the tent and anointed Solomon. Then they blew the trumpet, and all the people said, Long live King Solomon! And all the people went up after him, playing on pipes and rejoicing with great joy, so that the earth was split by their noise. Adonijah and all the guests who were with him heard it as they finished feasting. And when Joab heard the sound of the trumpet, he said, What does this uproar in the city mean? While he was still speaking, behold, Jonathan the son of Abiathar the priest came. And Adonijah said, Come in, for you are a worthy man, and bring good news. Jonathan answered Adonijah, No, for our lord King David has made Solomon king, and the king has sent with him Zadok the priest, Nathan the prophet, and Benaiah the son of Jehoiada, and the Cherethites, and the Pelethites. And they made him ride on the king's mule. And Zadok the priest and Nathan the prophet have anointed him king at Gihon. And they have gone up from there rejoicing, so that the city is in an uproar. This is the noise that you have heard. Solomon sits on the royal throne. Moreover, the king's servants came to congratulate our lord King David, saying, May your God make the name of Solomon more famous than yours, and make his throne greater than your throne. And the king bowed himself on the bed, and the king also said, Blessed be the Lord, the God of Israel, who has granted someone to sit on my throne this day, my own eyes seeing it. Then all the guests of Adonijah trembled and rose. And each went his own way. And Adonijah feared Solomon. So he arose and went and took hold of the horns of the altar. Then it was told Solomon, Behold, Adonijah fears King Solomon, for behold, he has laid hold of the horns of the altar, saying, Let King Solomon swear to me first that he will not put his servant to death with the sword. And Solomon said, If he will show himself a worthy man, not one of his hairs shall fall to the earth. But if wickedness is found in him, he shall die. So King Solomon sent, and they brought him down from the altar. And he came and paid homage to King Solomon. And Solomon said to him, Go to your house.
Thank you, Pippa and John, for reading. Let me have my welcome to Andrews. It's good to see such a crowd here as we begin our series in 1 Kings. And if you missed last week, we had a kind of overview introduction in which I try to persuade us that we actually care about kingship. And basically, if you missed last week's sermon, you can listen to it online. All of our sermons on the Grace Church Greenwich website or on the app, which Dave Butler wrote for your iPhone or your Google, whatever. Android, that's the one, Android. Or the summary is basically, watch Black Panther. Basically, that was last week's sermon. Because in the film Black Panther, there's a king who's actually a king. So we have a kind of figurehead monarchy, but in Black Panther, there's a king in whose hands the fate of the whole nation rests. He conquers, the nation conquers. He makes a terrible decision, the whole nation goes into a terrible decline. And that's much more like a king in a biblical sense, not just a figurehead monarchy, but an actual monarchy, one who controls your destiny. And we're just trying to think. We have a staff meeting each week where we review the previous week's sermon. And I was saying, you know, did we really get the traction with the idea we care about a king? And people said, not really. So we were just thinking about it a bit more. And various ways in which actually we do look for leadership or we do look for strength. And it actually turns out that we find that across a whole variety of different walks of life. So people like to back the winner or to be on the side of the winner. So people at work, they like to work in a team with a dynamic boss who's going in the right direction. In the country, we like to have a country with a strong government. And maybe we're not feeling so confident at the moment in Britain, but people like that. We vote for that. We want power. But actually, even in the places where you might think people don't care at all about monarchy, Molly was telling us about some of the young people she works with on estates in London, and how actually often people are in abusive relationships because they side with strength. They want to find the gang leader or the person who's the most powerful. And we try to summarize it in a little parody of the Bob Dylan song. His song was, "You've Got to Serve Somebody." And my little twist on it was, you want to serve somebody. All of us inevitably will end up choosing leaders and following leaders. There's no one who's leader neutral in our world. We all end up backing someone. And that's the issue in 1 Kings. Who do we back and who will reign us? Who will rule over us? And it's the issue in this chapter. I put down on the introduction on the little service sheet, the question, who will sit on the throne, which comes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 times in our passage. Who is it who is going to be the ruler over Israel? Who is it who's going to be the ruler over the whole of the world? Now, I want you to imagine that there's a little bit more suspense as we come to this chapter than actually there is. Because the trouble is that we all know how the story ends. I thought Andrew did a really good job with the kids' talk. I love the what goes up must come down illustration. Kids' talks can go hilariously wrong. You never have to plan the comedy because the comedy is always provided by the children. And I remember very, very clearly one of the first kids' talks I heard as a Christian going to church that had kids' talks when I was at university. And the talk was all about Superman. Superman had been relaunched on the TV. It just shows how long ago that was when I was at university, about 20 years ago. And the question was all about Superman. And so the guy asked the children, you know, who is it who can fly, who has X-ray vision, who can see everything that's going on? And the answer was, Jesus. And that kind of, you know, it really fell quite flat because that was meant to be the punchline that you get through several stages later. But you've got to imagine the same sort of spoiler that we all know where this ends. Who sits on the throne? Well, we know the answer is Jesus. Jesus rose from the dead. He's now seated in heaven. But the first readers of 1 and 2 Kings didn't know that. So you've got to try and imagine yourself into their shoes and read it with genuine suspense. In fact, for them, the question of who will sit on the throne was maximally uncertain. And people reading this at the end of the book of 2 Kings, I guess the first readers have to be people who are around at the time it ended, because that's when it was published. And it takes all the way through into the Babylonian exile, when there is no king. All you've got is a governor in exile, far, far away from Israel, without a crown on. And they're wondering, is there going to be a king? Are those promises made to David of an eternal king and an eternal kingdom really going to come true? The future seems really in the balance. Now, it's not in the balance. The suspense is killed. We know how it ends. A little bit later on, I'll have some thoughts about how it might help us, even as we do know how it ends. But firstly, let's read it as though we were them, with real suspense. Who will sit on the throne? And of course, the answer here is Solomon. It starts with King David. It moves to King Solomon. At the beginning of the narrative, we get Solomon in his bedroom. And by the end of the narrative, we get to, we get David in his bedroom through to Solomon at his party, rejoicing over his new throne. But the journey from A to B is not a straightforward one. And the kingship of Solomon is contested and is rivaled. And it doesn't look so secure at all. I've put the first point here. Beware the suave, sneaky, self-appointed king. The climax maybe of the chapter, long live King Solomon. But you might have noticed in chapter 1, verse 25, someone gets in there first with long live King Adonijah. You've probably never heard of Adonijah, unless you've been reading 1 Kings, ready for this sermon. Solomon's much, much more famous. We know how the story turns out. But at the time, he was the rival, and we wonder whether he might seize the throne. Now, in order to really understand this chapter, we need to know a bit of the backstory. And I'm going to take a leaf out of my GCSE biology teacher's book. So I hesitate to share this publicly, but I'm going to. We all did rather well in GCSE biology. I think most of the class got an A. Our teacher's very, very good. In particular, she had a very effective targeted revision strategy. So I remember we were about to do a study on osmosis, where we would stick bits of beetroot in different concentrations of saline solution, and then they would kind of curl up by different amounts. Just before we did this assessed practical, she came into class and said, oh, we're going to have a practical later, but firstly, completely unrelated, a little bit of revision. I thought it was always good to do some revision, so today we're going to revise osmosis. And so you've got us all sort of chanting the key phrases. Water moves from an area of high water potential to a region of low water potential through a semi-permeable membrane. I can still remember it years later. And she drilled into us. What kind of membrane? A semi-permeable membrane. Of course, everyone in the class then wrote down the beetroot curled up because of a semi-permeable membrane. Everyone got an A. Okay, so highly targeted revision at the beginning of the lesson for something that you might just need a little bit later on in the lesson. We're going to do the same thing so that we get more out of 1 Kings. Let me tell you a little bit about King David, the first great king of Israel, back in 2 Samuel. King David has a rival to the throne, a man called Ish-bosheth. And as he's about to be crowned king, Ish-bosheth crowns himself king, and we're not quite sure he's going to win. There's a civil war, and in the end, David comes out on top. A little bit later on, David has another rival, one of his own family, one of his own sons, a man called Absalom. And the thing you need to know about Absalom is he was very, very good looking. He was the pin-up boy of the book of 2 Samuel. We're told he had long, flowing hair. I can't see where that correlates to good looks, but anyway, he had long hair and he was dashingly handsome. Okay, backstory, rival Ish-bosheth, rival Absalom. Absalom is a looker. You need to know that. The other thing you need to know is that David's best mates are the prophet Nathan, a guy called Benaniah, and some mighty men. Okay, that's the story of David. Now, David was the greatest king of Israel's history. They always look back to David as the golden standard king. This is the story of what happens when David is an old man. In fact, he's so old that he can no longer get warm, verse 1. Although they covered him with clothes, he couldn't get warm. So they have a solution. Instead of getting, he's already tried the 15-tog duvet. They haven't invented electric blankets in those days, but they have invented rather attractive young women called Abishag. And so they find Abishag and say, go and cuddle up to the king and you'll be the equivalent of an electric blanket or hot water bottle, and keep him warm. And we're told, verse 4, the young woman was very, very beautiful, and she was of service to the king, and she attended to him and kept him warm, but he didn't know her. Now, unfortunately, this is a little bit of biblical euphemism, which basically means they didn't have sex with each other. And the ESV has faithfully rendered the Hebrew. He didn't know. It sounds a bit strange. What? She was in his bed every night and he didn't know who she was? No, he knows who she was, but he didn't know her intimately. They didn't have sexual relations, which I think is the author's way of saying he really is very old. He's so old that he's cold. He's so old that he can't even get excited when there's very, very attractive ladies in his bed. He's so old that the throne is looking quite fragile. Because the guy who's on the throne, he's maybe even getting a bit senile. He's weak, he's cold, he's lost his virility, he's close to the end of his life. And along comes Adonijah into the power vacuum and says to himself, verse 5, I will be king. Now, actually, at face value, there's nothing particularly wrong with that, because Adonijah is one of the sons of King David, the eldest son. He would have expected that he might inherit the throne. But there are just a few clues to make us nervous if we've done some highly targeted revision. So just look at verse 5. Adonijah, the son of Haggith, exalted himself. Well, the kids talk will help us with this. What goes up must come down. He was someone who pushed himself right up to the top of the tree. He was ambitious. I think I would rather like to be the king, he says. Well, there's warning bells already. He prepared for himself chariots and horsemen and 50 men to run before him. If you want to be a king candidate, you need a pretty good entourage, and he gets that. Verse 6, his father had never at any time displeased him by asking, why have you done this? So I think it's code for he's a spoilt brat. His parents have never disciplined him. He's always got his own way. He was also, listen out for it, he was also a very handsome man, and he was born next after Absalom. So if you know the backstory, it just makes you a little bit nervous. We've seen someone very, very good looking, son of David, wanting the throne before. Here's somebody just like Absalom, says the author. You ought to just notice that. He conferred with Joab, the son of Zeruiah, and with Abiathar the priest. They followed with Adonijah and helped him. But Zadok the priest, Benaiah the son of Jehoiada, and Nathan the prophet, and Shimei and Rei and David's mighty men were not with Adonijah. There's just subtle clues that something isn't quite right with this candidate. He wants to exalt himself. He's ambitious. He's power hungry. He's good looking. There's nothing wrong with being good looking, but the author just underlines it for us. He's good looking very much like Absalom. Remember him? The popular rival. And he has this big party, and the guest list is very telling, because absent from the guest list are all of David's friends, the top priests, the top prophets, the mighty men aren't there. And there's one other person who's not invited. Just look down at verse 9. Adonijah sacrificed sheep, oxen, fat and cattle by the serpent stone, which is beside En-Rogel. He invited all his brothers, the king's sons, all the royal family, and all the royal officials of Judah, but he didn't invite Nathan the prophet, or Benaniah, or the mighty men, or Solomon, his brother. It's carefully chosen guest list. I think I'll be king. I don't think I'll invite any of David's trusted loyal companions, and I don't think I'll invite my little brother Solomon, the one who's actually supposed to be the king. See, Adonijah is sneaky, and he's suave, and he's popular, and he's good looking. And if it's a democracy, he's getting the vote. It's not a democracy, but he's got the popular vote. And yet warning bells sound for us. This would not be a suitable king. The proud, self-serving, ambitious rival. This is not going to be the king like David. This isn't going to be the one who will keep David's throne secure, a king after God's own heart. Beware the rival. I put beware as my point, point number one. And then I sort of had second thoughts about it, because I thought, actually, the text isn't really saying beware. It's like suspense in a film. It's there to get your heart racing. You know, could this guy be the one who overthrows David and Solomon and ends up on the throne? But by the end of the chapter, it's not a beware message so much as a don't worry message. You don't have to beware, actually. He's not actually a real threat. He looks like a credible threat, but in the end, it comes to nothing. One of my favorite headings, I've been looking at various commentaries, including the one by Dale Ralph Davis. He's brilliant on 1-2 Kings, and he just has the heading, "The Party's Over," which I love that. When Adonijah hears, "What's this big celebration?" And it turns out, bad luck. David is now king. And he's like, oh. And you can imagine the music stops and no one finishes the champagne. There's no actual threat, because Solomon ends up established as king after all. But how is it that Solomon ends up safely on the throne? Actually, things do look quite precarious, because David is so old and so cold and so forgetful and so in a world of his own that he doesn't even seem to notice what's going on. It's only Nathan the prophet who discovers this plot of Adonijah's and goes and rouses Bathsheba, Solomon's mum, and says, come on, we've got to do something. We've got to go and tell David. He doesn't even realize. Verse 13, tell David, didn't you, my lord the king, swear to your servant, saying, Solomon shall reign after me, and he shall sit on my throne? And they get this little plot, and it's as if David really, really needs reminding. So the plot is that Bathsheba will go in. Now, verse 15, the king was very old, just a little reminder. Bathsheba goes in and tells him, do you realize Adonijah's on the throne, and it's meant to be Solomon? Then just as she's finished speaking, in rushes Nathan, and he says, isn't Solomon supposed to be the king? Because Adonijah's crowned himself the king. It's like a sort of double reminder. And then finally, David wakes up and says, ah, yes, I need to do something. Solomon is supposed to be the king. Quickly go and sneakily blow the trumpet and crown him king. So you've got these two parties. You've got the Adonijah party, and then you've got the David party with our favorite cast list. Zadok the priest, Nathan the prophet, and trumpets, and an actual throne, and the blessing of his father. And the plot comes off. Last week, if you remember the children's talk, Julia told us lots of different ways of recognizing a king. And one of them was that they have a crown. Crowns indicate kings. One of them that they're in the royal family. If your dad's a king, you're going to be the king. Well, in this case, every single possible dimension of making it clear that he's the king is given one by one by one. So look at the report to Adonijah. There he is having his party, and they hear this very, very loud sound, and they're told, no, King David has made Solomon king, and he was with Zadok the priest, Nathan the prophet, Benaiah son of Jehoiada, and the Cherethites and Pelethites, and they made him ride on the king's mule. I know that sounds more like a donkey ride the beats to us, but imagine it's the royal horse. And Solomon's on the royal horse going through the streets. And they've anointed him king at Gihon, and they've gone up from rejoicing, and the whole city is in uproar. And Solomon sits on the throne, and all the servants came to congratulate him and said, the name of Solomon is going to be even more famous than yours, and his throne will be greater than your throne. And even King David bowed before his son, King Solomon, and he blessed the Lord. I mean, you couldn't get more clear than that, could you? The king's mule, the king himself, Zadok the priest, you know that from the coronation anthem for British. They always play Handel, Zadok the priest. The right priest, the right prophet Nathan, the right mighty men, all the people in the city, huge celebration, and then even a prayer to God. Sorry, mate, it's over. Solomon has beat you to it. Don't worry about the rival. There is a secure successor. But whose doing is it? There's just one person that isn't. It's not Solomon's doing. He's entirely passive throughout the whole thing. It's not even King David's doing. He's old and forgetful and seems not even to notice what's going on. In fact, the one who seems to orchestrate it all is Nathan. That prompts one commentator. I brought this commentary to read to you, basically because it's so bad. Normally I give quotes of good things. This is a quote of a bad thing. Most commentators have for some reason bought Nathan's story at face value, he says. But he actually thinks it's invented out of entire thin air by sneaky Nathan combined with a tiger mum, Bathsheba. A memory of a vow called out of thin air, half-truths, unsubstantiated allegations, deferential speech, or contrived confirmation by Bathsheba's words. So according to Nelson, what's going on is Adonijah's being sneaky and getting himself made king, and then Nathan and Bathsheba are also sneaky, and they decide to get Solomon to be made king. And so they go and repeat to King David an oath that he never actually made, saying, do you remember that you promised that Solomon would be the king? And then the other one comes in, do you remember that you promised that Solomon would be the king? And he goes, oh yeah, I think I said Solomon would be the king. And so it's Nathan's sneaky plot over and against Adonijah's sneaky plot. Very weird thing to say, I think, because the one thing we know about Nathan is he is God's prophet. He's only appeared twice in the Bible to give us extremely important words from God. Once about the eternal dynasty, 2 Samuel 7. Once about the fall of David's kingdom in 2 Samuel chapter 12. And this is the third time that Nathan appears. Nathan, the prophet of the Lord. And I think the reason it's Nathan who orchestrates everything is it just reminds us that it's God and God's prophet and God's word that is in the driving seat. Behind all the intrigue, behind all the questions, David realizes, verse 29, as the Lord lives, who has redeemed my soul out of every adversity, as I swore to you by the God of Israel, Solomon, your son, shall reign after me, and he shall sit on my throne. Even so, I will do this day. Verse 48, blessed be the Lord, the God of Israel, who has granted someone to sit on my throne this day, my own eyes seeing it. It wasn't Adonijah who was successful. It wasn't a sneaky Nathan who was successful. It wasn't a senile David who was successful. It wasn't a passive Solomon who was successful. It was a faithful God who chose his successor and put him on the throne. And I've put there at the top of the right-hand column, verse 29, compared to 2 Samuel chapter 4, verse 9. Because this phrase, as the Lord lives, who has redeemed my soul out of every adversity, is word for word the same thing that David said when he himself is delivered from his rival Ish-bosheth. In other words, God is the one who keeps delivering his true king from their rivals and keeps placing his true king on the throne. As he did for David, so he does for Solomon. As he does for Solomon, so he'll do for Rehoboam, although Rehoboam's a bit of an idiot king. As he does for Rehoboam, so he'll do all the way through the line of kings, all the way through the genealogy of Matthew chapter 1, until we get to King Jesus. Now, I know we don't feel the fragility of that, because we know how it ends. We don't feel that it's precarious, that maybe the wrong person might get in power, because we know that it's Jesus who was risen from the dead. But at the time for the first readers, they really didn't know. Off in Babylon in exile, no king to speak of apart from the king of Babylon, or the king of Persia later. Who will be on the throne of the universe? All sorts of rivals to the throne. All sorts of popular rivals. Good looking, sneaky, popular, with key backers. And yet behind the scenes, God acts to make sure that the succession passes down the family tree
generation by generation by generation by generation, until one is born of Joseph, who is married to Mary, who is called the Christ.
Now, okay, I've been pleading with you, imagine what it's like to be in suspense. And no one's really convinced because we're not in suspense. So we're saying, what does this passage say to me as somebody living this side of the secure coronation of King Jesus? Because who's going to be the Messiah is not a question that many Christians sort of worry about, is it? Well, I wonder who it's going to be. Do you think it's going to be Jesus, or is it going to be, you know, whatever other candidate, I can't remember his name, David Icke or whoever it was, you know, some of the crazy madman messiahs. Christians know the answer to that. It's going to be Jesus. But if you ask another question, is Jesus' kingdom going to triumph? Is his church going to advance? Are rivals to grab the power of the United Kingdom, or to control the religious curriculum of children in the world? Are they going to triumph? Will Jesus' kingdom lose out? Will his church be trampled? Then it's much more of a live question. The king can't be opposed anymore because he's already crowned. But his kingdom can be opposed. And Andrew and I often talk about our sermons during the week, and I phoned Andrew, so I'm really struggling. What does this passage say to us now we're not in suspense anymore? And he helpfully says, well, there's actually a passage in the book of Acts when the apostles and the church is opposed, and they quote from Psalm 2, reminding themselves how the Messiah was opposed. As the Messiah was opposed, so his people are opposed. As there was a rival to the throne, so there was a rival to the church. So there are other people gunning for the hearts and minds of people in the UK. And the curriculum of our children and the ideology of the future generation. And it actually does look quite precarious. The Adonijah party is doing quite well in the UK, I'd say. They got the great backers. They got the great hair, he says bitterly. The TV personalities, the celebrity endorsements, the famous atheists. I mean, it seems like now you can't be an A-lister comedian without being an atheist and making half your jokes against God or against Christians in some way. And we wonder, who will triumph in the end? Moreover, it looks like some of the people who are meant to be in charge are looking quite weak. A weak King David, old and cold and a bit forgetful. Well, you think, well, we don't have much confidence in the national church, the Church of England. That looks pretty weak and precarious. We don't have much confidence in the professors of theology. We don't have much confidence in the BBC to educate us about what's true, right? It looks like we're weak. It looks like the rival king, Adonijah, might sit on the throne. But no. No, God will make sure that his king is redeemed out of every adversity. His church will be built. And so the end of his life, a very old and cold King David, is able to say with some spark of real joy, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of Israel, who has granted someone to sit on my throne this day, mine own eyes seeing it." And I guess we're confident that the end of our life, as the resurrection comes and the new creation is brought in, and we look out at a great kingdom with people from every tribe and language and nation, we will say, and not only did he establish that king, but he established his kingdom. And his rivals are destroyed, and they didn't triumph. And King Jesus will reign forever and ever. We ought to care who's going to be the king. We ought to care about which kingdom will triumph. And there is a battle right now in the UK, a battle of the kingdoms. But if we know the story of 1 Kings chapter 1, we know who wins, because we know there is a God who will deliver his king and establish his kingdom.